The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
It is. And we are going to begin with a song. So everybody, sing along. Whoops. I think. Oh, no, it goes like this. Oh, man. I screwed it up from the very beginning. All right, you ready? Here we go.
Ready?
Yep.
Okay. How was that?
When are you going to put it in?
Speed up, inject me fast. I need an antibody blast, so come and ram that needle home. Need a vaccine, so give it to me. Ba-da-da-da-da-da-da, give it to me. Hey there, Fauci, what you knowin'? How's the vaccine program going? Ain't you got no shot for me? Do it, do do, give it to me. Da 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 da, give it to me. Hey Joe Biden, tell the nation, screwed by Trump's administration. Need to find some more vaccine. Find it quick and give it to me. Da 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 da. No fever, no coughing, no trouble with sleep. The test found no virus, I can't set a beep. So load that syringe up and plunge it in deep. Vaccination, give it to me.
Na 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 na, give it to me. What day is today? Wednesday. That is the Parody Project. I've been holding on to that one until I could actually play and say, I got my first shot. So I got my first Moderna vaccine today. I go back in 4 weeks from today. That would be March 24th to get the second one. So here's the thing. In Florida, up until this week, unless you got really lucky and somebody, I guess, pulled some favors or strings in your favor, you couldn't get a vaccine if you were under 65 years old. It didn't matter what conditions you have. So I had been signing up everywhere, and I got to tell you, the most useful resource I found was this COVID vaccine group for Florida on Facebook. So I know a lot of people have a thing with Facebook, and I don't blame you. I get it. No problem. Sorry. But if you are on Facebook, look and see if there's a local for your state, a COVID vaccine group, because people share information. It's how David, my husband, got his a couple of weeks ago because I was able to sign him up for a Marlins stadium, which is way the hell down in Miami. But he was able to get in. Now, his whole thing, the first shot, I think it was like 8 hours in total because it's an hour down there. He sat in his car in line for many hours and then got the vaccine and then had to fight traffic coming back. My experience today, oh my God, here's what happened. So there's a hospital in Fort Lauderdale, Holy Cross. And Holy Cross Hospital, I heard through this Facebook group, was allowing people under 65, what, five hours, sorry, under 65 with one of the CDC's conditions that they list on the CDC website can get a vaccine. So, but to do it through Holy Cross, every hospital, every location has a different process. For Holy Cross, they have a packet, a four-page, you know, thing that you have to fill out. So I downloaded that. I filled it out. They say you need to get a letter from your doctor. Well, and my doctor said, yeah, no problem. But I think everybody was calling his office. This is the oncologist. So it was taking so long. And with Holy Cross, you have to bring the package of papers down there in person. So David took it down for me yesterday, but I hadn't gotten the letter from the doctor yet. So I just went on to my, I have a whole booklet with all my stuff from the cancer diagnosis. And all I did was take the diagnoses, print it out, you know, two instances of lung cancer, non-small cell adenocarcinoma, I think is what it's called officially. He brought it down there. They told him, well, everything's in order. That's good. She'll get a phone call. Hold on 1 second, caller. I'll be right with you. And they said, we'll call her. We'll make the appointment. And then before David even got home from Holy Cross, they were on my phone making an appointment. The appointment was for 12 noon today. Went in, got the shot. It took 20 minutes. And that includes the 15 minutes I had to wait after being injected to make sure there's no immediate side effects. It was simple. And they gave me not only my appointment card for March 24th, noon, for my follow-up, and my little CDC COVID-19 vaccination card. So I'm all official. All right. Somebody's calling in. Hi, who's this?
It's Rodney Lewis. How are you?
Hi, I'm sorry, too.
This is Rodney.
Rodney. Hey, Rodney. Where are you calling from?
Oklahoma City.
Hey. Okay. How are things in Oklahoma City right now?
I got a question.
Okay.
Don't we pay the salaries of the congressmen?
Don't we pay the salaries of the congressmen? Yeah. Why are you asking? Okay. What's the question?
My question is, you don't want to get $15 raises. Why can't we just cut their salary? What if we just stop paying taxes? How would they feel?
One thing has nothing to do with the other. I don't understand the point you're trying to make.
My point is, they whine over $15 an hour for just the common man. They make $83.36 an hour.
Okay, well, you know what? They do a totally different job. It's not a minimum wage job. I'm not defending the paycheck that Congress people get, but... You know, what they make and what we get for minimum wage, I think, are mutually exclusive. One doesn't have anything to do with the other. Let's talk about a $15 an hour minimum wage. And why would they fight against that? What I suggest is they should have to live for a week on a $15 an hour salary, which would, I believe, that comes out to $600 for a 40-hour week. And then you take taxes out on top of that. So figure they take home $350. I want them to have to, as they've gone through, many of them have gone through the food stamp challenge to see if they could survive on a week's worth of food stamps. I want to see them survive on a minimum wage salary for a week. And then, you know, I think they just don't know what it's like living in the real world. That's the problem.
Yeah, but what I don't understand is they give themselves raises at night.
They give themselves raises at night? What are you talking about?
What I'm talking about is they do it when nobody's around.
No, they don't.
Not listening.
No, they don't. Where do you get this stuff? What are you listening to? You listening to Fox? Stop that.
Oh, no.
You're making shit up.
No.
Don't make shit up here. They don't give themselves raises in the middle of the night. Doesn't work that way.
I'm sorry.
Legislation gets passed, whether it's for a raise for them or anything else they do, in the open. Sorry. Fox will tell you they do it in the dead of night. They do not.
Right. And another thing, this COVID thing, I'm African-American, and I did the study. Hello?
You did the study? What? Hello? Okay, Rodney.
Yeah, I'm here.
What study? What are you talking about?
I did the COVID study.
What COVID study?
COVID study?
What study?
They gave me the COVID. I got the vaccine, so I don't have to worry about going through.
Oh, you were part of the trial for the vaccine? Good for you.
Yeah, so I'm good. I tried to get my mother, she's 80 years old, took me like a month to try to get her get vaccinated.
Yeah, it's difficult.
She got a first shot, huh?
It's difficult.
She got a first shot, so I'm good.
Okay, well, I'm glad to hear it. Thanks for calling, Rodney. Okay. Yeah, the thing is, there are a lot of older people who you've got to jump through hoops to get the shot. And yeah, I'm glad I got mine. But I'll tell you something. I worked hard to get it. I mean, I was on that Facebook group day and night, and today trying to give advice to people who are still in trying to get it. And but I had somebody get really mad at me. Apparently on the CDC website, one of the it's not even a diagnosis. One of the things they list as an indicator to get the vaccine is smoking. So I try to explain to people. So my husband's dropped off my paperwork yesterday, and within 30 minutes, I got a phone call to schedule the appointment for today. A dear friend of mine who lives up in Palm Beach just finished treatment for breast cancer. And boy, they ran her through everything. Chemo and radiation and a surgery and all that. And her doctor would not give her a note because he said, you're done with chemo, which I'm sorry. I would tell the doctor, screw you, buddy. I'll find somebody else to pay my hard earned money to. So he wouldn't give her a note. So I told her I didn't have a note either. Go through all your paperwork and find something official that has your diagnosis on it. That's all you need. Sure enough, she drove down this morning. And as we were driving to Holy Cross, she was heading home saying, I was just there. They gave me an appointment on the spot. I'm going in tomorrow. So the problem is, if you're 80 something years old, you're not going to have the energy of a young, spry 61 year old. Seriously, and a lot of people have their kids and grandchildren working on it for them. They need to make it easier. That said, look, we're trying something here. The government is trying something here. They've got how many hundreds of millions of people are in this country? It's like 300 and some odd millions of people. So it's going to be a tough situation, and we all need to get the vaccine. But did you hear what Meghan McCain said? Meghan McCain apparently had a bit of a meltdown on the View. I just got to play this for you. This is too funny. And the reason I know about it is because when I said yesterday that I had an appointment for today, somebody tweeted to me and said, I'm Meghan McCain. I'm the co-host of The View. Don't you know I should be able to get? And I'm like, what is this? And I went searching. And sure enough, Meghan, here's what she did. Here's what she said.
The fact that I, Meghan McCain, co-host of The View, I don't know when or how I will be able to get a vaccine because the rollout for my age range and my health is so nebulous. I have no idea when and how I can get it. I want to get it. If you call me at 3 o'clock in the morning,
oh my God,
I will go any place at any time to get it.
Okay.
I want to be responsible and obviously wait my turn. But this rollout has been a disaster. The fact that I, Meghan McCain, co-host of The View.
Oh, okay. Sorry. It's repeating now. The fact that I, Meghan McCain, co-host of The View, don't know when or where I'm going to get vaccinated. She's like 30 something. And from what I understand, healthy. Guess what, lady? Wait in line. Oh, and then later on, that was just a short clip. Later on, she says, now I'm not trying to cut in line or anything. Yeah, you are. And she also then said, by the way, Dr. Fauci, I am over him. Can't we get somebody else who knows science who can like answer questions? I'm just so over him. Boy, the entitlement there is just incredible. Yeah. So this is where people are. People are. Oh, so I was telling you the smoking guy. So smoking is one of the things on the list. So this guy on the Facebook group says to me, well, how long was it after you dropped off your paperwork that they called you? And I said, couldn't have been more than 30 minutes. And he goes, well, I dropped mine off days ago. And obviously I'm emoting for him. He wrote it on a Facebook group. I don't know what he sounded like. I'm sort of relaying the voice that I hear in my head when I read his words. And he says, well, why didn't I get it? And I said, well, I have a feeling they do it based on the diagnosis. And the more serious the diagnosis, the quicker you get called for an appointment. Witnessed by my lung cancer and my friend Julie's breast cancer, right? So I said, what is your diagnosis? And he writes back, smoking. Smoking. And I said, well, that's not really a diagnosis. I understand that they say people who smoke may be at higher risk of COVID, but smoking is something that you choose to do. You could just not smoke and then you wouldn't be at risk. And he went nuts on me. Well, you know, but, you know, I don't know what he said exactly, but he got really mad. He's like, how dare you? That's like saying somebody who's obese, you know, they can just stop eating. And I said, no, not at all. not at all. Because there are metabolic issues and sometimes people have no control over their weight. But smoking is a choice. And he wrote back something like, well, if you're going to be like that, I've got no time to waste on the crazy. yeah, he needs to look in the mirror. So anyway, that's my good news. So far, so good. I'm feeling fine. Not even, I thought I felt a little lightheaded before, but I'm probably just, you know, looking for something. So far, arm's a little sore at the injection site, but that's about it. Meanwhile, wow, today was a busy day. I told you this week has been busy on Capitol Hill. It's hearing season. So let me try to bring you up to speed on what's going on and let you know that Rick Perlstein is going to join us today. Rick Perlstein is the expert on modern conservatism. He wrote the book Nixon Land. He wrote, you know, he's written a number of books all about the right wing of the United States, starting from Nixon, actually starting from Goldwater and moving forward. And his latest book is Reaganland. And yes, it is that big. And it's about to come out in paperback. This was actually a galley. So I have this copy that I got early and I have the hardcover book. And the paperback is about to come out. Anyway, he's fascinating. And I invited him on the show, right, you know, after Rush Limbaugh died, because I saw a great interview that Greg Sargent of The Washington Post did with him about Rush Limbaugh's influence over the Republican Party. And it was too short. And I emailed him and he's like, yeah, a lot of that got left on the cutting room floor. I said, good, come on my show and let's talk about it. So he'll be here today. And my thought is all these books he's written are all about the rise of the Republican Party. I don't even want to say the conservative movement because I don't think today's Republicans are conservative. But, and I'm wondering if now his next book has to be about the fall of the Republican Party because I don't see how they pull out of this free fall that they're in. So anyway, Rick Perlstein coming up in just a little bit. So stick around for that. Let me tell you what's been going on in Congress today. We are still waiting for the Senate parliamentarian to rule on whether or not the minimum wage, what our caller was just asking about, can be included in this COVID relief bill under reconciliation, which means they only need 50 votes rather than 60 to pass it. So it could come today or it could come tomorrow. It's up to this one woman, the Senate parliamentarian. Neera Tanden, you've heard me talk about her. She's the head of the Center for American Progress. Not exactly progressive America's best friend. Anyway, she is nominated to be the director of the Office of Management and Budget. It was scheduled to go to a vote today in the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee this morning. I guess it was left to Bernie Sanders, of all people, to call Neera Tanden and say we're postponing the vote. You see, Joe Manchin said he's voting against her. And none of their, you know, occasional reliable Republicans appeared to be willing to step out to vote in favor of confirming her. The usual suspects, Susan Collins, Mitt Romney, both said, sorry, we're not voting for her. As did a number of others. So her nomination is on hold. The White House says they're not ready to table her nomination yet or to pull it, but it's not looking really good. On the other hand, I told you today is day two in the hearings for Javier Becerra, who is the nominee to be the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and Deb Haaland, who is the nominee to be the Interior Secretary. And Manchin was like objecting to those as well. And all I could think is, what did these three have in common that doesn't apply to most of the other nominees. Well, go figure. Neera Tanden, although, look, I wouldn't vote to confirm her either because I think she's a horrible person on so many levels, and we talked about it. I don't need to get into it again now. I don't agree with her nomination. Out of all the nominations Biden's made, that's the one I would like to see not go through. So I'm not feeling too bad for her. Somebody, Nicole in the chat room is asking, did Bernie vote for her? They haven't voted on her yet because they don't have the votes to pass her. Bernie said he would. Because he's being a team player, but he shouldn't. Anyway, that one's up in the air. It may not ever come to a vote. But Manchin was showing a bit of reluctance about Javier Becerra, saying that he's not qualified enough. Are you kidding me? And Deb Haaland, and I don't know what Manchin's problem with her. The Republicans are going, she's radical. She's so radical. She protested the pipeline. Screw you. Manchin came out today and said he will vote for Deb Haaland. She looks to be in good shape. Today is day two of the hearings, but the hearings, as far as I could tell, weren't televised because there was other stuff going on. Yesterday, there were two Senate committees came together for the first public hearings on the January 6th, what they're calling a riot at the Capitol. I call it an insurrection. An attempted coup, an attempted overthrow of the government. So that happened yesterday, and I've got some sound if we have time for it. I played some in the news, and we'll what I've been doing now is at the end of the show, when we're done with Progressive Voices, I play the day's extended What's News version, so you get the full newscast that I never seem to have time to get to during the show these days. So we'll do that, and I'll bring you some of the back and forth on that. These same people, the former sergeants at arms in the House and the Senate, and the former head of the Capitol Police, all of whom resigned after the insurrection, all testified. Tomorrow, they're going to be back in the hot seat on a testifying before a House committee. This was in the Senate. Let's see. Today, keeping up with the beginning of the investigation into what happened January 6th, a House subcommittee was set to hear testimony to assess the damage from January 6th. According to at least one official's testimony, the price tag for the damage and increased security on Capitol Hill is already $30 million. But today, there was yet another hearing. I mean, I'm telling you, it was hearings galore. It was hearing palooza day on Capitol Hill. The House Subcommittee on Energy and Commerce today held a hearing called Fanning the Flames, Disinformation and Extremism in Media. All right. That's one I would have liked to have heard. But I'm telling you, the people that they had on here, I don't get it. It was chaired by Frank Pallone, Democrat of New Jersey. It said it's certain to take a critical look at conservative media outlets such as OAN, Newsmax, and Fox News in light of the stolen election conspiracy theory and all that. But the guests, the witnesses, are Soledad O'Brien, who we know. All right, so she's a journalist. Emily Bell, director of the Toe Center for Digital Media at Columbia University. Kristen Danielle Urquiza, founder of Marked by COVID, and Jonathan Turley, Fox News contributor and professor at George Washington University Law School. I don't get how that is representative of what's happening with our media. But so that went on today, too, as well as, see, I'm not done yet. Another confirmation hearing for Biden's CIA director nominee, Ambassador Bill Burns. Oh, and Louis DeJoy. Remember him? Yeah, the embattled Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy. There was a hearing in the House Oversight Committee about what's going on with the Postal Service. Now, news has been made. People are going, why is he still in that position? Because Joe Biden can't simply fire him. The way it works is the Postmaster General is appointed by the Board of Governors. The Board of Governors is put into place by the president. So Trump had stacked the deck with his Board of Governor people. Well, now there are a few empty seats. Joe Biden announced today three names that he's putting on the Board of Governors, all of whom seem to be right up our alley. And obviously, it looks like they will remove DeJoy from that position, as they should, because I'll tell you something. He was again testifying today. And let me just share with you a little bit of Katie Porter. Katie Porter is on the House Oversight Committee. And she got to ask DeJoy questions. And I always love it when Katie Porter asks anybody questions, but especially someone as smarmy as Louis DeJoy.
Thank you very much. Mr. DeJoy, do you know how big the Postal Service's deficit is?
So we lost $9.2 billion last year. Is that what you're asking? Or if you're asking about the $40 billion net equity? I'm sorry?
The unfunded liabilities and debt, please.
The unfunded liabilities and debt.
Total is about $80 billion right now.
Okay. When was the last time the Postal Service recorded a net profit?
He doesn't know.
7 years ago, 6 or 7 years ago.
Nope.
8 years ago.
Nope.
I believe it was 2006. Mr. DeJoy, how much longer until the Postal Service runs out of cash?
Good question.
We could run out of cash tomorrow if I pay our bills.
Oh, my God. We could. He sounds like a
and
at gangster.
At current levels, we can agree that 2021, now, soon. So my question for you is, you developed, last time we talked, you made some changes to the Postal Service in the summer and the fall. And according to the USPS Inspector General, the last time you made changes, you did not do any analysis of if those changes would save money. This is according to the USPS Inspector General. You're an executive and you did no analysis. Now, I've heard that you have a new strategic plan, but I'm really concerned that this plan may neither be a strategic nor a plan. Have you figured out if this new plan would save money and improve performance?
No.
First of all, I will
just the tone of his voice.
Respect the Inspector General.
What?
I disagree with your the premise of the conclusion.
Okay, I'm not going to torture you anymore. That is Louis DeJoy, currently the Postmaster General, but apparently not for too much longer. Because yes, it was announced today that Joe Biden is naming three new governors to the Board of Governors that oversees the Postal Service. It's the Board of Governors who gets to appoint or replace the Postmaster General. So it's taken a little time, but they're getting there, as they should. So I told you we have Rick Perlstein coming up. I have a little song to play for him as an intro. It's from one of my new favorite musical acts. It's a guy that we've got to know. His name is Bruce W. Nelson, but occasionally he uses his alter ego, an alternate persona, to do some of his songs. And that alter ego, that persona, is called Mangy Fetlocks. And Mangy Fetlocks basically releases a couple of songs pretty much every day on the YouTubes. And they're quick. This one runs, I don't know, a minute or so. But this one is called How Trump Compares to Other Past Presidents. And I thought that would be a great way to introduce, you know, Rick Perlstein, because he does tell us about the presidents in our past. At least he's been telling us since Nixon and Reagan. And so let's see what Mangy Fetlocks thinks, how Donald Trump compares to other past presidents. Take it. Oh, hold on. I got audio coming from somewhere. That's not good. Ah, I hate it when I do this. All right, I got to find where the audio is coming from. Where is it?
We're involved.
Okay, that's not good. Oh, I know. Give me 1 second. I think I just have to mute all these channels, I suppose. No, where is it coming from? All right, I'm going to have to play it a different way then. Ah, I'm so sorry. I can't even pull it up there. I can pull it up here. Damn it. All right. We'll just do the audio only because now I'm all screwed up. Give me a second. I see Rick looking at me like this is professional radio we're doing here. All right. So Mangy Fetlocks, where is your song? Man, oh man, oh man. Why do I do this to myself? I always get myself in trouble. All right. So I hope it's worth the big buildup. It goes like this. Where are you, mangy fatlocks? Here we go. All right. Now we can do it.
Howdy, folks. Way dumber than Obama and without Joe Biden's charm. Poor Donald Trump must feel rather small. Less dear to folks than FDR or John F. Kennedy. As president, Trump hardly rates at all. When twice you find you've been impeached and only had one term, your self-esteem drops and it hurts your pride. Comparison, I'd turn to William Taft. Trump looks a lot like him, viewed from the side.
And that's it. That's all she wrote. That's all he wrote. Mangy fatlocks, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that. All right, now, with that done, oh man, sometimes I should just stop. Oh, shoot. And now I can't get the picture of unbelievable. I think my battery died on my Rick Perlstein. Are you there?
Mangiest ever.
I see you. My mouse died and now I can't. Here we go. Oh, come on. I knew that the battery was dying. And
say, Nicole, did you grow a beard?
Yeah, no, that's still mangy fetlocks on the screen. Because, and now that's even worse. Hold on one second. I'm going to bring you, hold on. Now I got control of the mouse again. I can bring that over. And if I do this, your picture will come up just like magic. There he is. That was tortured. I apologize for that. I hope you enjoyed the song. William Taft from the side. Does that look like Donald Trump at all?
Wasn't he the president who got stuck in the bathtub or something?
I believe so. Yeah. So, Rick Perlstein, congratulations, Reaganland, the biggest book that I've read this year. America's Right Turn, 1976 to 1980, is now getting ready to come out in paperback.
Yeah, this summer.
And you said that this one was riddled with a lot of typos. So you're taking care of all that in the book?
Got to mention that one. Huh?
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Actually, there's actually a hardcover edition. If you buy it, there's about a 50-50 chance that you get the corrected hardcover version.
Oh. So. And this is a labor of love for you. I mean, when you turn in a book to the publisher, which in your case is Simon & Schuster, do they go, oh, my God, it's another 1,200-page book? What?
I can't even tell you how much stress and anguish there was. There was talk about releasing it in a 2-book box set.
Wow. Wow.
I didn't make things easy for anyone, but hand it to Simon & Schuster. They went for it. And things have worked out great. I've really been able to reach a lot of folks. And
without ever leaving your house, right? I mean, still no book tours are happening, are they?
Not leaving my house, absolutely. Yes, I've, you know, toured my living room and my dining room, yeah.
Right. So Rick Perlstein, again, with the new one is Reaganland, America's Right Turn, 1976 to 1980. Before that, we had Nixonland, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. We had Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater and the Unmaking of the American Consensus, and the Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan. So, I mean, modern right-wing America, the rise of the Republican Party in modern times. And I'm wondering if now your next book might have to be about the fall of the Republican Party, because, boy, they seem to be in bad shape right now.
Well, every time I write one of these books, the time period in which I write, you know, starting from the late 50s through 1980, there's always some point in all these books in which the Democrat wins, often by a landslide, and someone says the Republican Party is dead.
Right.
And, you know, basically the way the electoral system in America works, the two parties are so institutionalized that really they're the only game in town. So the Republican Party is going to be with us, you know, for the time being, unless they go the way of the Whigs, which seems to happen every century or so. But, you know, when Jimmy Carter became president in 1977, the ratio of Democrats in the House of Representatives to Republicans was more than 2-1. So at least we can look forward to, hopefully, you know, some serious time in the wilderness for these guys. And the more the Biden administration is able to do on the ground, you know, basically saving lives and, you know, using the government for good, the better chance we'll have that these guys will be in the wilderness for a while.
Well, let's hope. But it also there's this real fracturing in the Republican Party, where there's obviously infighting between some of the different factions. You got, you know, the biggest divide is the Trump part of the party and the never Trump part of the party. And most of the people in, I'm sorry, go ahead.
This is like either you're for Trump or you're part of the deep state, right?
Right. I mean, it's
like, that's the cunning of what Trump has set up for these guys. You deviate from him one inch and you're part of the conspiracy. So there's really no, you know, his ego is so big that he's going to bring this party down with him if he can possibly do it.
If he can do it. Right. And the chance, look, it looked like after January 6th that it was over for him. I mean, who could ever? This guy obviously incited this insurrection. There was no doubt in anyone's mind, even after when the Capitol building was cleared and they came back in. Even Lindsey Graham, who obviously had a few drinks on the break because his nerves were shot, I would imagine. And he's like, I'm done. I've had enough. This is it. I was with him. It was a great ride, but it's over. I can't do this anymore. And then he flies down the next weekend to Mar-a-Lago to kiss the ring. I'm trying to make it PG here. And they're all falling in line. Kevin McCarthy, same thing. He said on the floor during this joint session that obviously Donald Trump is responsible here. Then he goes down there and they're all falling at his feet again. I don't recall, and you would know because you're the historian, Rick Perlstein, has there ever been, at least in recent memory, a president who loses after one term that remains the titular head of the party?
No, that's not the way it works. They're usually, you know, cast into the outer darkness, right?
Right.
When Richard Nixon, you know, wrote his memoirs and they came out in 1978, there was this big crusade, you know, don't buy books. Don't buy books from crooks, right? The irony is the one guy who wouldn't let go of Richard Nixon and said Watergate was no big deal was the guy who ended up being the, you know, crusader who brought back the Republican Party, and that was Ronald Reagan.
Oh, my God.
So, you know, it's very weird, right? It's very weird. It's this kind of like Führer Prinzip, the great leader. You know, they're so obsessed with this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, what are they going to do, right? I mean, the guy literally has a cult behind him. And it's an impossible situation for these guys, right? I mean, for anyone who's sane, it's not.
Right. It's sort of you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. There's Liz Cheney, as her dad says it, Liz Cheney, who is speaking truth to power. I mean, she came out and, I can't play anything from that computer right now. I'm not going to try. Because I got sound coming. Oh, now it's stopping. Okay. Something must have been playing that on my wall of sound here.
I can imitate her.
Can you? Yeah, there was a little disconnect today.
Go see my daddy.
Go see my daddy. Yeah, there was a disconnect today with Republican leadership. This is what happened.
Just very briefly, you and the leadership, especially Congresswoman Cheney, do you believe President Trump should be speaking, or former President Trump should be speaking at CPAC this weekend?
Yes, he should.
That was Kevin McCarthy.
Congresswoman Cheney?
That's up to CPAC. I've been clear my views about President Trump and the extent to which following January 6th, I don't believe that he should be playing a role in the future of the party or the country.
And so she says that he shouldn't do it. And
on that high note?
And then Kevin McCarthy says, and on that high note, we're done. You see Steve Scalise sort of scowling and shaking his head as she's speaking. So you're either, you know, with him or against him. But now I'm hearing talk of a bunch of, you know, former administration officials, Republican administration, obviously, and other party people who are just not with Trump, talking about forming another party. We haven't had a forming a new party, splitting away. So there's the Trump contingent, which is also talking about doing the Trump party. There's the Never Trumpers talking about doing another Republican party. They seem to be split in three, which would be a lovely way to split up the Republican Party in my book.
Yeah, when Abraham Lincoln won in 1860, there were four parties on the ballot. That's why he was able to squeak by.
Right.
You know, one of the parties was the Union Party, whose platform was we shouldn't talk about slavery.
Okay. All right.
So we basically have, you know, like the Republican Party divided between the people who are, you know, the loyalists of the Q, you know, conspiracy theory, and the people who are the loyalists of the Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction conspiracy theory. Right.
Right.
And none of them are any good.
Right.
It's like Liz Cheney represents some wing of the party that represents some return to, you know, decent American values, because unless she plans on denouncing her father, and I don't think she does, you know, this is the guy who literally said that the Constitution doesn't apply to me because I'm my own fourth branch of government. Yeah. You know, so, you know, I mean, it's not like they're returning to some kind of majority coalition, you know, that seeks to kind of govern well and compassionately in the interests of the broad majority of Americans. I mean, this is a raw, naked battle for power. Let's not pretend that Liz Cheney represents something humane. And
oh, God, no. I would never do that. Right. So she's obviously making a calculation that right there will be more reasonable people, as is are people like Kinzinger, whatever his name is, the congressman from Illinois, whose family disowned him because he went against a good Christian man in Donald Trump. Like, what? I mean, this is opposite world.
You're awfully ashamed of him. Yeah. I went on the top of my Facebook page, that letter or something else.
It was crazy. You know?
Triple underlining.
Wow. And you know, when there's triple underlining, that's almost as good as triple exclamation points. And you know what? The family said they were disappointed in him. It doesn't get much worse than that. But I'm looking at there's two new polls out today, a Politico Morning Consult poll and an Economist YouGov poll. And they both have, like, Joe Biden is up, has a 20-point popularity, 58 to 38. You know, favorable to unfavorable. Kamala Harris, 52 to 39. Pelosi, 38 to 50. Trump comes in fourth, 37 to 60. Chuck Schumer, 31, 39. Kevin McCarthy, 20, 40. And Mitch McConnell, 17 approval to 17 in favor, 61 unfavorable. So, you know, Trump's still got the high unfavorables, but the Democrats seem to be doing the right things right now. The question is, what happens with the other party? That's, you know, and I don't know anybody knows. What do you think is going to happen?
I do not know. I know when you're a pundit and you're supposed to be an expert, you're supposed to have these wise, all-knowing answers.
You are.
I would be lying. You know, no one has any idea. Right. And, but, you know, we can, you know, use the advantage of the chaos in the other party to just basically confidently go about our business, right? The folks who are, you know, running the House and the Senate should set the agenda, right? Not be afraid of passing things without any Republican support, because look, I mean, the kind of things they're passing are incredibly popular. We're talking about, you know, helping people keep their businesses, you know, being able to hug their grandkids.
Yes.
You know? All sorts of, you know, wonderful plans, you know, like paid family leave. And if they pass this kind of stuff, you know, they have a once in a generation opportunity to help people relearn that the government can be their friend. You know, this could be the end of the Reagan regime. And, you know, and we have another generation coming up behind. Let's face it. You know, I'm an old man myself, you know, coming up behind the Nancy Pelosi's and the Chuck Schumer's.
Please. Yeah, we have the oldest. I'm sorry. I'm not an ageist. I'm old myself. I'm 61 years old. I'm no spring chicken. However, the leadership in the Democratic Party, and I don't know if I read this from you or somewhere else recently, but it is the oldest leadership. It hasn't changed in decades. The average age and leadership in the Democratic Party in the House is Nancy Pelosi, Jim Clyburn, Steny Hoyer. I think the average age between them is around 80. I'm sorry. And then Jim Clyburn had the nerve to say, we're the future of the Democratic Party. Respectfully, sir, no, you are not.
Well, good for Joe Biden. He actually has said that
he's younger.
Transitional figure to the next generation of Democrats, you know, which is kind of what I love about Joe Biden. He really does not give a fig, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, he knows that this is his last rodeo, and he's perfectly willing to check his ego at the door, really. It's quite remarkable. I think he's showing a lot of leadership. He's showing an excellent example of kind of self-possession and leadership. And you know, this is going to be a slow and steady thing, but I think he's going to keep some of that popularity.
I think so too, because he's trying to help people. And again, the polling on the programs, I mean, the COVID relief program, everything is sky high. People want this. They want the $15 an hour minimum wage. They want the help that he's willing to give them. So how do the Republicans then justify voting against it? Do they just not understand there's, you know, cause and effect?
In a dream world, and there's followers that are living in a dream world, right? I mean, let's not speak, you know, too ill of the dead. Well, okay, what the heck? You know,
yes, Limbaugh,
you know, spent, you know, 35 years, mm-hmm. really teaching his, you know, millions of followers that anything a Democrat says is a lie.
Yep.
You know, anything a Democrat does is a conspiracy against you. So, you know, it's going to take a lot of sanding away of that kind of particular rough edge. You know, it's a process, and we're putting one foot in front of the other.
Right.
And we have a good team in place. I really do wish that Biden would change the position on forgiving student loans, right? Mm-hmm. That would be a great way to put a bushel full of young folks in the basket for 2020.
Oh, yeah. That would do that. And older folks, too, who still have debt after 20 years, where they've paid it off for 20 years and their balance is still what the principal was or more.
Has Barack and Michelle, have they paid off their student debts yet?
I think they did. I think they could afford it.
They hit a windfall.
A little bit.
Right off White House. I think she still had student debts.
Yes. When they went into the White House, I think they both did.
Right.
So, you know, there's an issue there. My whole thing, we went through this earlier in the week or last week. I think they need to fix the issue of how student debt is loaned and how the penalties are, lobbed onto it, which is the problem.
You know, I mean, it's like there's way too much basically systems in place that kind of funnel free cash to, you know, whether it's insurance companies, whether it's banks, you know, this is all overhead that, you know, the rest of the civilized world manages to do without.
Right.
You know, step at a time, you know, but, these are all opportunities.
Yes.
You know, and this is I'm optimistic, you know.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. So Rick Perlstein, you mentioned Rush Limbaugh, and yes, you have an open invitation here anytime. I'd love to talk with you anytime. The door's always open. But I read the interview or the article that Greg Sargent wrote at the Washington Post of your interview after Rush Limbaugh died, and my first thought was that was way too short. And when I reached out to you, you said a lot of it wound up on the cutting room floor. I said, good, let's talk about it then, because here, you know, your book, Reaganland, really ends as Ronald Reagan takes office. So, and that's about the same time that Rush Limbaugh started cutting through, like 1989, right? Is my timing correct? So did Rush Limbaugh come in after Reagan?
Yeah, and I actually was driving a delivery route in 1989 after my freshman year of college.
Wow.
So, you know, Rush Limbaugh is probably responsible for this insane career I launched out. I was listening to him for 4 hours a day, and I was like,
you?
Wow, it's really interesting. This guy is telling a really, and I have to be absolutely frank, compelling story to people, right? I mean, I could immediately recognize the brilliance of his talent, right?
Back then, yeah. It was a different act than he did in his later years, yes?
It was pretty similar, actually.
Was it?
It was about cigars and, you know, like, I remember he was very big on the idea that liberals wanted to hand out free condoms in elementary schools. That was his big obsession,
mm-hmm.
right? No, but it was pretty much the same hatefulness. He had the cholera abortions, you know, he had the AIDS update,
yep.
right?
Yeah.
It was a very similar act. And the act basically amounted to my kind of, you know, aging white middle class male audience are oppressed,
yeah.
You know, by forces of political correctness, and together you and me are going to fight back. And it was just an incredibly compelling message. These guys treated him like a god, you know. The whole idea of the ditto head is very fascinating to me. You know this word in German, the Führerprinzip?
No.
What? Basically how they, what they used to describe, you know, the relationship that a proper German was supposed to have towards Hitler.
Hero worship, basically.
The leader says it, it's true, right? The leadership principle, the Führerprinzip. And the whole idea that the first thing any caller would do when they got on with Rush, they would say mega dittos, which basically meant I'm, you know, checking my critical faculties in the door and outsourcing my opinions to you. And the most interesting calls were always the ones in which people kind of came to him, you know, kind of as a supplicant, you know, kind of like a religious supplicant to a guru saying, how should I think about this? I don't understand this. And Rush was absolutely brilliant at kind of coming up with these very simple formulations, these kind of guides to the perplexed, for these guys, you know, kind of making their way through, you know, a diverse, confusing world that was changing beneath their feet. He gave them this kind of existential grounding. And it was always, you know, based on, you know, fundamentally this hatred, right?
Yeah.
This fear, this anxiety. But I remember one call in which this guy called in and he said, you know, Rush, everyone, you know, like is getting bigger and bigger cars, these, you know, pickup trucks and bigger SUVs. And I get it because, you know, those are the safest cars. But if everyone gets a bigger car than everyone else in order to be safer, doesn't that mean that everyone's going to be running each other off the road soon? And it was really interesting because here was a guy who kind of reasoned his own way to liberalism. Right. The idea that we're all together, you know, that, you know, ultimately, you know, we need coordinating things like government in order to make rules of the road. And he had come up with this all on his own. And Rush Limbaugh responded to him basically saying, you sound like a really smart guy. I bet you're going to have a, you're going to be able to do fine and get a perfectly huge car. And suddenly he'd solved the problem for the guy.
Oh, God. You know?
He's like, the world is a war of all against all, and people like you and me, we're going to dominate it.
Okay, so Ronald Reagan, actually, is the guy who came up with the term Make America Great Again. In fact, I've got a little campaign button on the Chyron underneath you. That was him. Donald Trump never gives him credit for that. Donald Trump acts as if he made it up himself. But Donald Trump is not responsible for any of his own success, I don't believe, except the fact that he's a prodigious liar. He's really good at lying and making stuff up. But in terms of getting him
great again,
I'm sorry, say that again.
He did make America great again. Great again.
He did. I think that's a matter of opinion. I beg to differ, but the fact remains he stole the marketing slogan and claimed it as his own. I'm wondering.
He stole Law and Order. He stole, you know, his dad's fortune, you know,
everything. Never had an original thought of his own, but he pretends it's all his. So I don't think he was responsible for his rise. I think the ground was tended to make it fertile for him, for somebody like him. And I think Rush Limbaugh
absolutely
tilled the soil, put in the fertilizer to complete the analogy.
When Trump decided he was going to run for president, he basically got one of his janissaries to sit there in front of talk radio for hours every day and take notes about what people wanted to hear. He literally did.
Wow. Yeah. See, he takes his lead from them. He sees which way the wind is blowing and says, I'll do that, which is what he did.
Talk about immigration. Talk about immigration. And he kept on forgetting until they told him they could build a wall. And he loved that idea.
Oh, my God.
And he turned into, you know, kind of Genghis Khan and he was all about it. And next thing you know, he's built the wall, and that was his story, and he was going to stick to it. And that's how kind of dumb he was. You know, they kind of needed to come up with some kind of ego trip for him in order to get him to stay focused.
But then what does that say about 74 million Americans who voted for him, who, you know, that's what blew my mind. Not that, you know, I figured he'd lose, but the fact that he lost, but got more votes than any other candidate in history, except for Joe Biden in this very election. It's crazy.
Well, I'm thinking about the disinformation machine, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, most sophisticated techniques of emotional manipulation, right? I mean, you saw, you know, you must have seen, you know, the movie about Fox News and Megyn Kelly,
Bombshell, right?
Bombshell. Yeah, I remember the one elder kind of host taught the younger host exactly the formula. You know, you terrify them, you titillate them. You terrify them, you titillate them, right? I mean, these are all basically, you know, 1984 George Orwell techniques. And they're all very sophisticated, and they're designed to loosen people's critical faculties, you know, and, you know, make it impossible for them to think critically, and to, you know, basically what cults do when they brainwash people. You know, not all 74 million of the people are brainwashed. Some of the 74 million people are like, I got a tax cut and I'm going
to
keep it.
That's it. Right? That's it. And that's all they think about. They don't think about what it does to everybody else. And they don't think about what a heinous individual this man is and continues to be. And they're still supporting him, which, again,
some of them are, you know, kind of white men who, you know, want to dominate, right? And identify with him as an alpha male who dominates people. So the things that most horrify us, you know, are most exciting to them. And the part of the con is that, you know, they believe that he, you know, is, you know, he might be a con man, but he's our con man. He's conning those guys on behalf of us, right? Which, of course, you know,
he's conning them. The fact that he kept raising money after he lost the election, ostensibly for legal fees to fight to stop the steal, all that money went into his pocket. That's all this is about, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's still going in his pocket, but a lot of that money that's in his pocket now is going to go at the, you know,
to legal fees. Go figure.
You know, once the Attorney General's office gets, you know, Letitia James and Cy Vance.
That's right.
And we make it the last laugh yet.
Let's hope. But meanwhile, you have the current members of the Republican Party in elected office saying, well, we're going to keep this guy as our leader. So it precludes any of them from launching their own 2024 campaign because Donald Trump says he's running again. He's not running again.
You know, the Tom Cottons and the Josh Hawleys, when you ask people who they want to see for president in 2024, they're getting like 1%, 2%.
Yeah, I know.
To 3%, you know.
He's again sucking all the air out of the room, and he will do that. Now, it's fine with me. But I can't imagine the Marco Rubios and the Josh Hawleys are happy about.
I wonder how many of them are just kind of betting that he's going to keel over one day. You know, well, one too many big castles.
Right. And he probably should, you know, follow the lead of his old friend Rush Limbaugh. Not to dance on anybody's grave, but hey, if you were ever going to dance on somebody's grave, that's the perfect person to do it to. So I got to ask you, back in 89, when you were listening to Rush Limbaugh, you're a progressive today. I mean, I think I know. Were you then?
Yeah.
But you still listen to him?
I did appreciate, you know, I was young, you know, I was 19. And some of the things he would, you know, make you say if you didn't have the right information, right? And, you know, being a kind of, you know, teenage boy who probably had some resentments of the girls who were not giving him attention. I think there's a lot of seductiveness to that, right? Every once in a while, I'll be like, wow, maybe he has a point. Wow, it's crazy that they would give, you know, condoms to eighth graders as if they were really doing that, right? But he would, you know, he was very skilled at finding just the emotional issue to kind of yoke people in, right?
But is this something unique? Did this develop with Trump, or did this come out of, you know, Newt Gingrich, the lying, the total refusal to accept fact as fact? I mean, they will not stipulate that the sky is blue and the grass is green when you can't even come to an agreement on those basic facts because they won't agree to anything.
There's a long history of this in America and also in the Republican Party, right? I mean, think about Joseph McCarthy.
Oh, right? Yeah, right.
And the reason America is, you know, facing any hardships in the world is what he said. It was a conspiracy so vast to dwarf any in the history of mankind, which was the conspiracy was supposedly, you know, the Democrats were infiltrated by communists, right?
Right.
And then before that, the Ku Klux Klan was extremely powerful in the 1920s, right?
Yeah.
They ran the state of Indiana. They ran the state of Oregon. They weren't responsible for the immigration bill of 1924. There were millions of members. You know, they marched down Pennsylvania Avenue. And their conspiracy theory was that the Catholic Church was a secret conspiracy, you know, that the Pope was going to take over America, right? So, you know, there's a long history of this, right? And American history has always been this struggle between the forces of progress and the forces of reaction. And a big part of what's going on in America right now is, you know, the way politics took shape in, you know, the segregationist South and even the slave South before that, you know, was basically spread throughout the country by the conservative Republicans. You know, Barry Goldwater, you know, after he won, one of his delegates from Texas said, we just moved the Mason-Dixon line up to Canada. Right. And, you know, that's not going to go away. This is a country, you know, that is this, you know, completely saturated with some very dark forces. And luckily, we have the majority now.
On a tightrope. I mean, it's a razor thin majority.
Oh, but no, 7 million people voted. More people voted for Biden than voted for.
Oh, I agree on that front. But I'm talking, you know, legislatively. If you look in Congress, you got a five vote margin in the House and not a vote to spare in the Senate.
Because we're 50-50 in the Senate, even though 56% of the population of the country voted for Democrats for Senate.
Right.
So we got a systematically rigged constitution that's designed to give people in rural areas more power. Right.
Right.
The Democrats got to get serious about constitutional reform. They got to introduce some new states. They got to end the filibuster.
All of that.
We're talking about, you know, the fate of the planet here. This is not just fun and games, you know.
Right. So you have. I'm sorry, we're running over because I can't let you go yet because there's too much to ask you about. You have a the Voting Rights Act, for instance. Since Donald Trump's failed. Big lie that they stole the election. It was actually the most, unproblematic election we've had in a while. And I think it's because so many of us used paper ballots. That's why.
And vote by mail is great. My sister's been voting by mail in Oregon for 10 years now.
I've been in Florida. So what do they do now? The Republicans are introducing legislation to limit voting by mail because it worked. So they have to break it. Are the American people going to stand for that, or are they going to see through it finally, or is that just where we are?
Look, I mean, even today we have, you know, the postal board, you know, being reclaimed by the forces of decency and competence, right?
Please.
We have one of the new members is a member, you know, a leader in the Postal Workers Union. One's a vote by mail advocate.
Mm-hmm.
Right? These are sane, competent people. And, you know, so like I say, we're headed in the right direction. I'm optimistic.
I'm glad to hear it. So you think Joe Biden will continue to grow? Look, his popularity right now, he's up there higher, I think, than Obama was at this point. People are happy he's getting stuff done. So maybe common sense will win out.
It's happened before.
It has. All right. Any idea what your next book is going to be, or is it too soon to even look there?
Not yet. Watch this space.
We certainly will. Rick Perlstein is his name. The book Reaganland, America's Right Turn, 1976 to 1980 is out, but the paperback version is coming soon this summer. So look out for that. Rick, thank you so much. It's always great to talk with you. I'm so sorry about our awkward beginning. I hope you enjoyed the song for all it was worth.
It was mangy.
It was mangy, wasn't it? All right.
Thank you.
Talk
Bye-bye.
To you soon. Bye-bye. Tomorrow is Thursday. That means Howie Klein will be here, as he is every Thursday. So we've got a lot to talk with him about. And I told you, we're starting, we're already late, long past the end of Progressive Voices. But I will leave you with today's What's News to give you a full look at what's happening in the news. I'll see you tomorrow, everyone. Thanks for listening.
I read the news today.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Congress is a hotbed of activity this week with hearings, votes, and markups galore. On Wednesday, the Senate parliamentarian could issue her ruling on whether the $15 minimum wage provision can be included in the COVID relief bill under reconciliation. Or it could come Thursday. There was a vote scheduled in the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee at 10 a.m. Wednesday morning on Neera Tanden's nomination to be director of the Office of Management and Budget. Well, that vote has now been postponed as Tanden's confirmation prospects dim by the moment. With Democrat Joe Manchin declaring that he'll vote against her, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is trying to find a Republican to cross over, but so far has been unsuccessful. Meanwhile, Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, a close ally of Manchin's, is also a member of the committee, and she hasn't said how she'll vote. this could all be moot. Two of Biden's other nominees, who happen to be people of color, have also come up against resistance. Health and Human Services nominee Javier Becerra and Interior Secretary nominee Deb Haaland both have their second day of confirmation hearings on Wednesday. The mostly unexpected pushback, again coming from Senator Manchin and the Republicans, are notable, as the three nominees that they're objecting to are all people of color. Two Senate committees held the first public hearing on the January 6th riot at the Capitol. A lot of discrepancies were apparent in the testimony, as three former Capitol security officers seemed to have different recollections of the sequence of events. One major issue concerned a bombshell FBI memo sent the day before the insurrection with an explicit warning about potential violence. Former U.S. Capitol Police Chief Stephen Sund claimed that he had only learned about the memo the day before his testimony, on Monday of this week. Again, the FBI released it on January 5th. Washington Post published it on January 12th. But Sund, who was at the time the Capitol Police Chief, is just now hearing of its existence? So Sund and the former sergeants at arms for the House and the Senate, who all resigned under pressure after the riots, blamed the FBI, the Trump administration, and each other for what happened on January 6th. They said the attack was unpredictable and unforeseeable, despite Trump supporters openly planning the attack online in the days and weeks leading up to that day. Sund and Paul Irving, who's the former House Sergeant at Arms, disagreed about the timing of a request for National Guard assistance and why it was so slow to be answered, and a lot more. This same group will go before the House on Thursday. And on Wednesday, a House subcommittee is set to hear testimony to assess the damage from the insurrection. According to at least one official's testimony, the price tag for damage and increased Capitol Hill security is already $30 million. Well, the Senate was busy on Tuesday. They confirmed Tom Vilsack as Biden's new agriculture secretary, sending the former Iowa governor back to the same cabinet position he served in for the entirety of the Obama administration. The Senate also confirmed Linda Thompson Greenfield to be the new UN ambassador. And there's still more happening in Congress on Wednesday. For example, the confirmation hearing for Biden's CIA director nominee, Ambassador Bill Burns, begins as he testifies before the Senate Intelligence Committee. Remember the embattled Trump-appointed Postmaster General who did his best to destroy the U.S. Postal Service? Well, Louis DeJoy is back on the Hill Wednesday answering questions before the House Oversight Committee. But this time, Democrats don't seem to be united in working to oust him. Some are pushing for a brand new slate of governors who could immediately fire DeJoy. But others are taking a more moderate approach, hoping they can instead work with him and cut a deal on a long-awaited bill to overhaul the Postal Service. Oversight Committee Chairman Carolyn Maloney is in the latter group. It makes no sense at all. The latest we've heard from DeJoy is that he is working to try to slow down the mail service while at the same time raising prices. Seriously. And the House Appropriations Committee is holding a hearing on the mental status of Capitol Hill employees following the January 6th insurrection. From the What Will It Take files, dozens of protesters gathered in Rochester, New York Tuesday night after a grand jury voted not to indict any of the police involved in the March death of Daniel Prude. We all saw the video. Police officers shown on body camera video holding the 41-year-old Daniel Prude down, naked and handcuffed on a city street last winter until he stopped breathing, will not face criminal charges. Prude was having a mental health episode when the cops handcuffed him, covered his head, and held him on the ground. He died a week later. New York's Attorney General Letitia James, in announcing the grand jury decision, also said that a judge granted her permission to release the minutes from the grand jury. Meanwhile, in Northern California, the family of 30-year-old Angelo Quinto has filed a wrongful death claim, saying that Mr. Quinto died days after police officers kneeled on the back of his neck for nearly 5 minutes to subdue him again during a mental health episode in December. Amazing. And then there were three. On Wednesday morning, the FDA released its review of the single-shot coronavirus vaccine, this one made by Johnson & Johnson. Their finding, it was safe and effective, and that it completely prevented hospitalizations and deaths in a large clinical trial. The vaccine could be authorized as soon as this weekend. And on a personal note, I'm getting my first Moderna dose today. We're making progress, one shot at a time. I got the news. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.